please. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-1091. Union Artists and Petitioner v. Netflix and the State of Florida et al. Mr. Winton for the petitioner, Ms. Karen for the prosecutor.
Good morning, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Gregory Winton. I represent the petitioner, Newton Dixon.
Now we're back in order. Is that, I take it? We had reordered the cases, but we're back to the original order now. I take it whoever had a medical problem, it's been resolved. So.
This is the second case?
It's a new printing I have in front of me, I guess. I'm sorry. We do have the second case first. Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you. We're here today because the NTSB once again issued an opinion and order which was arbitrary and capricious, and it should be vacated for two reasons. One, again, the NTSB departed from its longstanding precedent without any explanation. And number two, which is really related to the first, is that its decision affirming the law judge is not based upon any substantial evidence in the record. Specifically, what we're talking about here is the weighing of expert testimony. This case, as you know, involves...
Doesn't that give you a real problem? If we're talking about the weighing of evidence, we don't do that. We don't reweigh evidence.
Correct.
If that's what we're talking about, then isn't it our proper notation, one word affirmed, and we go to the next case?
What you need to do, Your Honor, rightfully so, is to look at the NTSB and see if they weighed the evidence properly in accordance with their precedent. And what is their precedent? Long-standing precedent.
Well, before we get to their precedent, let me be sure I understand the burden of proof. You bore the burden of proof in the proceeding, correct?
We did, correct.
Okay.
But you have to presume, one, that what the FAA says is got some validity in fact. So the FAA can't just come to an airman and say, you have a medical condition.
No, but they had a number of expert witnesses who testified that he did.
Correct. But the question is, the ALJ's decision was silent on the logic, objectivity, persuasiveness, and depth of that expert medical testimony. And so was the NTSB's decision affirming the law judge. The standard there, which was articulated in the petition of Witter and other cases, is that the board articulated its precedent that in weighing medical testimony, it shall review the expert testimony and draw conclusions based on the quality of the opinions. The quality of the opinions depends upon the logic, objectivity, persuasiveness, and depth of the medical opinions. Now, other precedent, which was found in petition of Olson 6 NTSB.
Instead of the precedent, tell us what aspect of the NTSB or the ALJ opinion you think doesn't properly weigh.
The ALJ was silent on any of the medical testimony of the administrator's witnesses, and more so, didn't even mention the objectivity, depth, or persuasiveness of petitioner's expert witness, who was the only treating physician and, quite frankly, the only one that came to the court with valid medically proved statistics of what is a seizure. See, in this case, what we have is the FAA says there's evidence of a seizure. And I think that they put aside their valid test and adopted a new test, which I'd like to call the Ten Commandments test, because if you remember the Cecil B. DeMille movie, Yul Brynner said, so it is written, so it shall be. So the law judge said, if it's in the records, it shall be a seizure. And the NTSB said, well, if the law judge says it's in the records, it shall be, then we say the law judge is correct. In this case, when we talk about substantial evidence, there is evidence only of Mr. Newton Dixon stood up and he fell down. He hit his head on the table. He was bleeding from the nose and mouth. He was conscious. He was breathing. His eyes were vacant. And a bystander, an eyewitness said, I think he's shivering. That's the only substantial evidence we have. Dr. Hauser for the FAA said, amnesia and confusion are consistent with a closed head injury, i.e. concussion. Dr. Hastings for the FAA.
That does not Got a whole lot of ice by itself, counsel. Say it's consistent with a concussion does not mean it's not also consistent with a seizure.
Correct. But what else do we have?
You really don't have anything that says it's inconsistent with seizure.
Well, we do. That's where the telltale signs, Judge, of a seizure.
No, that says that amnesia of the event is inconsistent with seizure. It is consistent with seizure.
It's as well as a concussion. But
it doesn't matter whether it's also consistent with concussion, does it, counsel?
Correct.
I mean, you understand the burden of persuasion here, or the standard of review here.
I do. And if we look at all the evidence in the file, okay, what Dr. Hastings for the FAA said is that the telltale signs of a seizure are postictal sleep. There was none here. Self-injury, there was none. Incontinence, there was none.
Incontinence occurred in, what, 24% of seizure cases?
Correct. But if we
does
go
that
through...
that mean there's 76% it does not occur?
That's correct. But if you add those probabilities up with...
You don't add up probabilities.
I'm sorry?
You don't add up probabilities.
Well...
It's a matter of set theory. If you've got a set of the persons who've had seizures, you have a subset of 24% have incontinence, 26% or whatever it is percent has tongue biting, that doesn't mean that you add those together to get a 50%. You have some overlap of the subset.
Oh, that's true.
It could be a total overlap for all we know from...
But what we're looking at is the absence of all these symptoms. There is not one.
Right. And we have no idea in how many cases it occurs that there is an absence. But we do know that it isn't, that there is some set in which there is none of these present. No doctor has ever testified, and no evidence has ever been offered, that 100% of cases does not include a subset in which you have neither tongue biting nor incontinence.
That may be so, but what we don't have here is any medical clinical evidence of a seizure other than what was written in the initial report. There's no symptoms of fatigue, no headaches, no nausea, tongue biting, history of prior seizures. If we take the FAA's position, this man had no prior history of seizure. April 8, 2004 has a full-blown tonic-clonic seizure with no clinical evidence. And then he walks away, and 1 month later, apparently something happens in an airplane, which, by the way, the board seems to abandon that issue, and has a series of multiple seizures.
Why do you say the board abandoned it?
Because the board made a statement that the record is clear regarding the law judge's determination that at least one unexplained disturbance of consciousness occurred. Such a finding disqualifies a petitioner. And that would say...
How is that abandoning?
Well, what they said was, with regard to the other decision of the IOE, initial operating experience flights, although there is certainly room for disagreement on whether petitioner suffered a partial complex seizure or a simple complex seizure, or whether the IOE incident constituted a seizure at all. So they're not sure either. So certainly that wasn't substantiated by evidence in the record.
That's very ingenious argument, counsel.
And that's at A197 for the record. But what we have here is, if you go according to the FAA, then he had these seizures and walked away from the second incident a month later and never had another seizure. And the FAA says, well, because we don't know whether he had another seizure, that doesn't mean he didn't have a seizure. You can't go by that. The medical...
Why can't you?
Well, you can't...
Now, wait a minute. I think the regulations give 10 years with no seizure as the time after which a pilot may reapply, doesn't it?
That's assuming that there were two...
At most, there's been 5 years passed now?
It's six and a half
six
now.
Six and a half now. Five when the briefing started or close to it. So I don't understand the process. You can't go like that.
Well, we had testimony from Rico Walker, who works with Mr. Dixon every day, 8 hours a day, and together on a weekend socially, said for the past 2 years prior to the trial, there were no... any seizure activity.
Right. So that's nowhere near 10 years.
Well, we're not saying you have to have 10 years. What I'm saying is...
Isn't that the regulation? Am I not right about that?
It's not the regulation. It was an unwritten policy that Dr. Hastings testified about. I couldn't find it anywhere.
It's a policy that was never turned up in writing.
Right. But the likelihood of this gentleman walking away from having two seizures within a month and then never having another one is impossible. He would either continuing having seizures to that level and either die or be medically treated to stop this.
How do we know that?
Oh, the statistics from Dr. Loftus, again, which were not even discussed in any of the decisions. Go on, I'd like to reserve some rebuttal time, but what we're saying here is that the NTSB and the law judge were silent on any kind of objective analysis of the medical testimony. They didn't even discuss it. All they said was, it's in the record, it must be true. If it's true, then he's disqualified. That is not the standard that the NTSB must be held to. And they are very specific on what they hold themselves to is weighing evidence in medical cases such as this. We ask that you vacate the decision of the board because it is not supported by substantial evidence, and more importantly, because they departed from their well-reasoned and well-accepted precedent.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give you back a couple minutes for rebuttal. Hear from the respondent.
Hi. If it pleases the court, I'm Susan Karen, and I represent the FAA in this matter. As a kind of threshold matter, I'd like to address some of Mr. Winton's argument that he just made to you.
There is good idea, yeah.
Substantial evidence in the record to support the NTSB's decision in this case. The board has plenary review authority over its law judges' decisions, and it went back, and if you look at its decision, it did a very detailed description of the testimony and the exhibits in the record. It looked at both incidences, the one in London, and it looked at the one on the training flights. With regard to the one in London, if you look at the record, you'll notice that while the EMS records, they don't attribute statements to anybody in particular, they do document evidence that our expert witnesses then use to offer their opinions at the hearing. Specifically, they address the fact that there was a postictal confusion when he was in the ambulance. That wasn't a statement, a hearsay statement attributed to somebody else. That was based on the observations of the EMS personnel. When he got to the hospital, a nurse did an intake with him. She again notated that there was postictal confusion. There's, I think it's called the Glasgow Coma Score. Dr. Hastings testified extensively about that, that when he was in the ambulance and again later, they were continually checking his vital signs. He scored 14, and that was significant of the postictal confusion that's associated with a generalized seizure. When he got to the hospital, an emergency room physician examined him, and then he was held overnight, and a neurologist examined him at that point. That neurologist independently corroborated what was in the EMS records by speaking to Ms. Myhill, and there's notes of that in Dr. Aloy's records. So the board details much of that in its decision. They note that the judge implicitly credited the medical records. In fact, he explicitly credited the medical records. He said he was going to give weight to them, which implicitly rejects Ms. Myhill's testimony at the hearing where she was recanting most of the things that were implicitly credited to her in the records and explicitly credited to her from Dr. Aloy's interview with her. With regard to the second incident, the one on the IOE training flights, the judge made an explicit credibility finding in favor of Captain Metzner. Captain Metzner observed the whole flight. He filed a detailed report that's in the record that shows the deterioration of Mr. Dixon. Those records also show that Captain Metzner is not medically trained, but he did perceive that there might be some medical problem related to this, so he summoned another airline personnel to see him. That airline personnel also notated that there was a problem with Captain Metzner's awareness of what was going on. Again, the judge credited all of that testimony, and the board, in reviewing this case, found no reason to disturb those findings. If you don't have questions for me at this point.
Seeing none, if you want to rest on your submission, I may do so.
I will, Your Honor. So at this point, I'll just ask that you affirm the board's decision and deny the petition for review.
Thank you, counsel. Okay, we'll give you an extra minute, make it 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you. It's interesting that Ms. Karen mentions the notes from Nurse Spicer, and those are found in A68 of the appendix. Specifically, she reports the GCS scale, glaucoma scale, at 15 over 15. She mentions it was 14 at the London Ambulance Service. So when they arrived, certainly he appeared confused, again, consistent with a closed head injury. But specific.
Also consistent with being post seizure, right?
It could be, absolutely. Now, with regard to Captain Metzner, he said that Mr. Dixon was a useful resource in the cockpit, and that's at A302 of the appendix. Certainly, if he had a three-hour-long partial seizure or multiple seizures during this flight, he wouldn't come in and out of usefulness only when the captain needed him. So it's inconsistent with the evidence.
That's taking a statement dramatically out of context, counsel. This is the same person who testified about how he was useless during a good part of the flight. Well, it was out of character to a man who had been useful in the cockpit.
Not necessarily with that crew member in that aircraft. So that's questionable. It's a completely different aircraft. We talk about a technologically advanced 757. But the case law that we have to look at is, in this court, Pasternak, which was a much smaller standard, where the substantial evidence of what the collector at a drug facility said or didn't say was not substantiated in the record. And this court sent it back on a remand saying we need more evidence or we need additional findings.
Isn't the problem here really what I started with, which was the burden of proof? The point you made about A197, I've looked at it. So it says, although there is certainly room for disagreement on whether the petitioner suffered a partial complex seizure or a simple complex seizure, or whether the IOE incident constituted a seizure or seizures at all, which is what you said, petitioner has only raised questions about the theories. He has not established that he did not suffer one or the other, or that the incident was something other than a seizure. And this goes to the burden of proof. It was the burden in the proceeding on your client to establish that he did not have a seizure. That's what you told me.
Right? It was.
So even if it's reasonable that he didn't have one, that doesn't establish the burden of proof that he didn't. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but you didn't meet the burden of proof of establishing that he didn't.
I'd like to say that I can tell you definitively whether we did or we didn't. Preponderance of the evidence is more likely than not. If you base the testimony of Dr. Loftus, which went uncontested for the most part, because he testified on rebuttal, then the judge should have talked about it.
Well, Dr. Loftus did not examine the patient at the time. He has nothing more to go on than the other evidence.
Well, what he said was the valid statistics accepted in the medical community concerning partial complex seizures is that it very rarely and almost never occurs more than two to five minutes. We're talking about a three-hour flight where the FAA doctors say he was in and out of consciousness or he was out of consciousness through the whole flight. And that just doesn't make any sense. There's the preponderance.
Had a number of doctors from a hospital which was identified as the best, if not in the world, certainly in England, saying that he did have a seizure. And that doctor did see him and did talk to people very soon after the time.
Maybe
that's not the only conclusion that could be reached. But why isn't it a conclusion that provides substantial evidence?
That goes to the first incident. Yes. So that first incident, yes, he was seen by the doctors. They found no clinical medical evidence to substantiate a seizure. If you look at their records, the initial impression was HI, head injury, with a question mark fit. Well, that's questionable. That was his first impression, Dr. Kennedy. And then, like a schoolyard game of telephone, when little Sally tells Tommy a secret and Tommy tells Jimmy and down the line, the last person to hear that story very rarely has the same story as the first person. So when the EMS people took down shivering and somebody wrote fit for whatever reason, because there's no evidence of any witness saying a fit or a seizure, then that statement carried through. If the fire department gets a call of, hey, the house next door is burning and it really is only smoke, that call operator is going to write burning house and they're going to show up expecting a fire. Where there's smoke, there's not always a fire.
I think we've had your answer and you're well over time. So right. Unless my colleagues have further questions.
Thank you for your time. We ask that you vacate the decision of the board.
Call the next case.